Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Monday, September 22nd, day 5 of our fall membership campaign. Today we hear from the University of Hawaii as it tries to get a clearer picture of the loss of Federal Department of Education funds. A recent order stands to cut the money next week. We talk with the Hawaii Bicycling League about an upcoming event just as the governor has issued an executive order out of concern for the traffic fatalities that are now closing in on 100. And in light of the cuts to public media, we honoho a recent interview with NPR's Mary Louise Kelly. It's a look behind the scenes at All Things Considered. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This week, the University of Hawaii administrators hope to learn more about how deep the cuts to its budget will be as a result of a decision by the Federal Department of Education to reduce funds for Alaska and Native Hawaiian programs. Chad Walton, the interim vice president for research and innovation at UH, says principal investigators of the various programs are meeting this morning with U.S. DOE officials to get clarification on the use of the discretionary funding. There are some programs that could see $10 million disappear next Tuesday. Title III has to do with funding for minority-serving institutions, specifically Native Hawaiian and Alaskan groups, and Title VI has to do with workforce development. Walton shares that there's another $45 million that could be impacted in the months to come. Here's Walton explaining what they know at this point in time while they seek clarification.
So the Title III Part A, the discretionary funds, those are the programs that receive the non-continuation notices. And University of Hawaii received 11 notices of the 22 programs that we have under that Title III Part A. The remaining balances, because these are multi-year awards, the total was $55.7 million of the value of the awards. But the total budget that's remaining is $10 million. So we're looking at a potential $10 million loss if we don't get the no-cost extensions through the next fiscal year.
And then you need clarification because you need to know how many warm bodies stand to be affected, depending on how you can spend the money.
Correct. So we're still assessing the personnel impact because it's not one person on a grant full time. People might be on multiple grants. They might be on grants for part of their salary. So we need to be able to assess exactly what's happening with each person and then know the total impact, if we can move people around or how we're going to address this. But we need to know the time frame and the monies that are available currently on these grants in order to do that properly.
And it may sound a little scary, $10 million. That's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, for these programs, these changes deeply affect the programs and services for our students, faculty, staff. Every dollar reflects lives, opportunities, and a sense of belonging that defines our community. These programs were really Hawaii-centered programs that were opportunities for all the students at every institution. The eligibility may be based on a quota for race or socioeconomic need, but the programs themselves were strengthening institution programs, so they do have deep impacts. They're really at the fabric of what we are at the University of Hawaii. It's really impactful for us, yes.
Were there any monies that were set aside as direct scholarship to students, let's say Pacific Islanders and Native Hawaiians?
No, these funds don't provide direct scholarships. As I said, they're for strengthening institutions. The programs themselves are called Strengthening Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian Serving Institution Program, and Strengthening Asian American, Native American, and Pacific Islander Serving Institutions. So they're designed for this infrastructure, provide opportunities for experiential learning, research, faculty development, infrastructure, all those things that would strengthen an institution, not for a specific race. It just happened to be that the eligibility was defined that way.
And I understand that there's been some information that's come out of the Department of Education that says some of the monies that will be taken from these funds will be reallocated to help the Blacks and Native tribes. Do you have any additional guidance or information on that?
That's what we're hearing as well, is that the monies in the notices for non-continuation, they say they're going to be redistributing these discretionary funds into other programs. So the HBCUs and the tribal colleges, yes, we're hearing that's where the money's been going as well, yeah.
Have you had any discussions with any of those schools that have those programs?
No, I haven't, no.
I understand that there's also some Title VI funds that are affected. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we also received non-continuation notices for Title VI, which is a program that supports workforce development by strengthening capacity for foreign languages, area studies, international studies. University of Hawaii holds 8 grants, the total $5.4 million under that, and all 8 received non-continuation notices. The same holds true for these, is that they're multi-year awards. So that 5.4 million accounts for the multi-year, so it's the total value of the award. But at risk right now is 802,000 under that program.
So less than a million for that. I guess if you can give us maybe some examples of the types of programs that we're talking about.
They're learning centers. So the foreign language learning centers, they're all at University of Hawaii at Manoa. But it's mostly the area studies and the learning. So the area studies being the Asian studies and Pacific Island studies. They're all the centers at Manoa, yes.
And then the university has been making a concerted effort to concentrate on workforce development in a lot of these key industries where we know there's a shortage, whether it's, I don't know, nursing or doctors or that kind of thing. Can we give any more specifics as to what types of workforce programs are we talking about?
This Title VI is for the workforce development. It's to train workforce to be culturally sensitive. The languages that apply to these different workforces enable them to actually work in areas where languages and different cultures exist. So losing that, we're losing that context, which makes Hawaii a really attractive place to learn because you're actually going to gain those perspectives. So that's what's going to be impacted by the loss of these.
Can you drill down even more specifically? Is there something for, I don't know, the Filipino community?
We have all the different types of area studies. So we have Pacific Asia studies encompasses a lot of the different cultures. But there's Hindu cultures as well. It's pretty much everything that you can see. There's 8 programs in total. Yeah.
Okay. Is there another category of funding that you're concerned about as well?
The Native Hawaiian Education Program was also affected. We received notices of reduction of funding in those grants. So they weren't terminated and they didn't receive non-continuation clauses, but 3 of our grants received notices that their budget was being reduced. And so that totaled $843,000 for those programs. And so those programs support innovative approaches to improving Native Hawaiian education success, emphasizing the Native Hawaiian language and culture to student development and well-being.
And is that just still though primarily here on Oahu?
Yes, yes.
Anything else on the community colleges, any programs that are tied to workforce development programs there?
The Title VI were all Manoa. The NHAP was Manoa. The Title III's, it's student success, and those were spread across all of the campuses except for one, Hawaii Community College being the only one that did not receive a non-continuation. So those aren't tied specifically to workforce development, though.
Okay, all right. So it's bad news, but we don't know if it will get worse. But immediately, it's $10 million.
Correct.
And possibly another million
for the Title VI.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else?
What's concerning, what you mentioned, we don't know what's coming, is that this is all predicated on a determination by the U.S. Solicitor General in July that Hispanic-serving institution programs were deemed unconstitutional and they violated the equal protection component of the Fifth Amendment. And so the Department of Education had taken the stance that all minority-serving institution programs had similar issues. So there are more minority-serving institution programs across different agencies. So we're very concerned about what may mean in the future for those programs as well.
And is there any talk about, I don't know, filing any legal challenges over these specific cuts?
I'm not sure what's being planned, but people are talking about it for sure, but I'm not sure what's being planned in the legal side.
Anything else that you think our listeners ought to know as we navigate this next week and a half? I know there's a potential government shutdown come October 1st as well, and I don't know how that might impact any of these.
Yeah, well, I think one thing is people are looking to philanthropic funding or state funding that might step in and wondering what the university's response will be to this. But there's no way that state funding or philanthropic funding can step in and replace federal money at this scope and scale for this time frames. But university leadership across the campus right now is looking at ways to assess impacts, and we're gathering all that information together to develop a strategy to sustain these programs that are so vital to really the fabric of who we are. Again, these are really define our communities on the campus, so they're very important to us.
Okay, and then just to allay people's fears, because when they hear funding for Native Hawaiian programs, that the School of Hawaiian Knowledge might be somehow impacted. Anything you want to say about that?
These programs, again, strengthen the whole institution. So obviously, those become the centerpieces to focus on, but it's really the campus-wide that the impacts are going to be felt. Yeah, because okay. It's not directed specifically for one student. It's for the whole institution.
And then some of the other schools that we've talked to said that they're sad because the characterization of this is race-based, and it's really not, that it does help somebody who may need help in whatever, math and science, that it's helping to raise the bar for everybody.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, that the eligibility is partially based on race and as well as socioeconomic need. But it's the grants themselves are for the entire institution. All students have access to these programs. They're Hawaii-centered. They're really speaking to the goal of the university to become a native Hawaiian place of learning, which will benefit all students. So have the entire student body have these benefits. So the eligibility gets obscured with what the intent is. But yeah, to make that clear, that the eligibility is simply the eligibility. But what you use the money for is for all students.
That was Chad Walton, Intern Vice President of Research and Innovation at the University of Hawaii. UH researchers and administrators are meeting today with federal DOE officials to get a better handle on what funds will disappear next week and what monies that are already allocated will be allowed to spend down. UH says funding for the Hawaiian Studies Department is provided separately by the state.
Support for HPR comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the Halau of O'iwi Art in Wailuku, Maui, committed to design that serves and celebrates the environment, culture, and community. FerraroChoi.com. Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
You know, Governor Josh Green last week issued an executive order in response to soaring road fatalities across the state. Last week, the statewide number was more than 90, and over the weekend, that number hit 62 here on Oahu. On Friday afternoon, we had a chance to talk to the head of the Hawaii Bicycling League. Travis Council is glad that more attention is being focused on road safety. The league's big century ride takes place this Sunday, and there are some 2,000 cyclists who will take part in that event that starts at Kapi'olani Park. There will be new road closures that motorists need to know about. For the first time, a stretch of Kalani'aniʻoli Highway will be closed to cars to allow participants to safely navigate the scenic section of the Kūbi Coast from Hanama Bay to Sandy Beach. Here's Council.
Our numbers are climbing, especially on the city and county of Honolulu side, but even statewide. I think we're at 94 fatalities currently, and we average about 100 a year, so we're not towards the end of the year yet. Unfortunately, we're not headed in the right direction there.
And so what can you tell us? Because a lot of these cases involve cyclists, and then with the advent of those e-bikes, so many more people are getting into collisions and sadly dying.
Yeah, so we're seeing probably a disproportionate number of people that we would consider in that vulnerable road users, whether it's people walking, biking, on the scooters, who end up on this fatality list, unfortunately, for such a variety of reasons. Some are people not paying attention, some are reckless driving, and they just happen to be the person that gets hit. But all too often, it does rely on people not paying attention, whether it's for themselves or the people around them. And that's our main message, is just slow down, look out for each other. I think all of our anxieties are a little higher than they might want to be, and make sure that's not the case when you're in the car and or on a bike or walking, just to make sure that we're moving around safely.
Yeah, I was saddened to hear of the loss of one of our cyclists, and he was, what I heard, coming down Tantalus, and someone was just coming out of a driveway.
Yeah, a very experienced cyclist, Wojtek. You know, he was doing an afternoon ride, and unfortunately, someone pulled out of a driveway without seeing him, and he passed away. So that's a great reminder that every single one of these 94 people so far this year has a story behind it. They're a loved one. They're a family member. They're a community member. This is a business owner we were just talking about that we're both connected with. And unfortunately, all too often, it just becomes a statistic. It becomes a number. You know, we get very focused on the numbers. But what we try to do is really focus on the person, the story. Take a minute and really say, that person's not coming home for dinner. That person isn't going to work the next day, or whatever it might be. And really remind us that we're all part of that same community. We're a small island. We're a small community. We can't have these losses.
Yes, we did have the loss of a couple on Oahu's west side also, as well on beach cruisers.
Yeah,
so you don't have to be going fast.
No, unfortunately, this is not something that's assigned to any one type of person or type of user. You can be walking down the sidewalk. You can be on your beach cruiser. You can be a professional athlete. You know, the full spectrum. It doesn't take much to, unfortunately, become a statistic.
Yeah, it could be as simple as you could be in a bike lane and someone in a car opens the car door.
Yeah, a lot of the numbers we're seeing this year, the common thread is a person in a vehicle, whether it's they didn't see somebody crossing the road or somebody crossed when they shouldn't have. But all too often, a vehicle is really that common ground, which is a great reminder that I drive, a lot of people own cars, and we often forget that how quickly a vehicle can become a deadly weapon. When you look at a phone, adjust the radio, whether you're busy in your head thinking about other things, all too often that vehicle could take someone's life quite easily.
Yeah, so we need people to pay attention and take better care.
Yes.
And the Hawaii Bicycling League has been working a lot with the city on the complete streets, trying to make things safer for everybody. And we've made great strides.
Yeah.
But I think the idea of safety, right, and bicycle education for our young cyclists, whether they live here on Oahu or on the neighbor islands.
Yeah, so I think education is key. We look at this, it's a federal program called the Safe Systems Approach. It means there's a lot of different ways that we can be safe, whether it's our infrastructure, which the Complete Streets Department's doing a great job, whether it's our enforcement, and I know HPD has challenges with being understaffed, but they're doing a great job where they can, and then the education, which is community-led, organization-led. So that's where we really focus, is that outreach, whether it's e-bike-specific classes. We have e-bike 101 classes that are free for anybody that wants to do those, whether it's just community events where we go out and talk about the rules of the road, the way that people should behave out on the road. And then, of course, we have keiki education at all the elementary schools. We've been doing this 35 years. We go to fourth grades, and with the goal of basically teaching them how to ride to school safely or even just around their neighborhood safely. And that's such a rewarding program.
Yeah, because it is distressing. We have had several cases of young children on those e-bikes or e-scooters. And we know that city and county has been working to try and tighten up the regulation just to keep everybody safe.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a situation where the technology is advancing faster than our laws, regulations, definitions. That's definitely part of the governor's executive order there as well, just recognizing that we have these devices. And then what comes with that is they seem fun. They seem like a toy at times. They're definitely not a toy. So all too often, somebody who's maybe less experienced out on the road or might not know the power that they're getting with an electric device are given these. And that's when we see these unfortunate crashes and hopefully not too often fatalities of people that might not know the rules or probably shouldn't be on these devices to begin with. You know, our goal is to provide that education so that if you are on those devices, regardless of your age, hopefully you'll have the skills and knowledge to do so safely.
And we're talking about safety on the road because the Hawaii Bicycling League has a big event coming up and you've got something new this year.
Yeah, so we have what we're calling the Ride Aloha Festival. It's a combination of a few events, but our main event there is the Honolulu Century Ride. This brings about 2,000 riders out on our roads. This is next Sunday on September 28th. And this is our 42nd year doing this. But as you mentioned, we're really excited this year, something new. We're closing off the Kaʻiwi coastline from Hanama Bay to Sandy Beach Park, just for outbound riders for a couple hours in the morning to really experience that car-free, gorgeous coastline and really get people out there and enjoying the bike.
Yeah, and the city has closed off that to cars for the Kaʻiwi walk. But first time for cyclists.
Yeah, this will be something new and different, kind of that open streets concept where you can show a different use for that road. That road is definitely a busy highway, winding, lots of cars, lots of scenic. So it might not be the most friendly place for people walking or biking on an average day. So we're grateful for the city and the state's support there where we can close it for just a couple hours, 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. So hopefully not impacting too many people. Still access to Hanama Bay, all those good things. But where these couple thousand people on bikes can really experience it and enjoy that scenic coastline.
Right, but you do want to get the word out because it is going to affect the traffic patterns.
Yeah, so we'll have detour signs and HPD will be out there. And again, full access to Hanama Bay for the folks that want to get there. And then everybody else will have to route around through Hawaii Kai for those couple hours.
And so what do folks need to know if they want to sign up if they haven't yet?
Yeah, so you can go to our website, hbl.org, or just next weekend, we have places at the Alawai Clubhouse. That's where our packet pickup is on Friday and Saturday. You can come sign up, do anywhere from 25 to 100 miles on this larger ride, or we have a more family-friendly option in the morning that's about an 8-mile ride in the Kahala area. So easiest way is go to our website, hbl.org, and you'll see all the info there.
And I'm just curious, because I remember when I did the Century Ride, we had a fair number of folks from Japan, and I don't know how you're doing this year, how that all works.
Yeah, so we've had a number of registrants, about 300 people coming over from Japan. Not quite back to the numbers previously, but we're definitely happy with that number coming back. We also have about 300 people coming from the continent as well, a big group from just outside San Francisco, big riding club who are coming over here to have a great time. We also have another person who's using this event as her bachelorette weekend, so bringing a lot of friends over to do the ride and celebrate afterwards. So yeah, fortunate that it's a great opportunity for our local riders to get out and enjoy, but also a fun option for people visiting Hawaii to get to see a scenic route.
Okay, not too late to sign up. Well, thank you so much, Travis Council.
Of course, yeah, thank you.
That was Travis Council of the Hawaii Bicycling League talking to us about the executive order that Governor Josh Green just issued in light of the rising fatalities on our roadways across the state. Honolulu Bicycling League has its big century ride coming up this Sunday. For the first time, the road from Hanama Bay to Sandy Beach will be closed to motorists from 6 to 8 a.m. More than 2,000 cyclists are taking part in that ride. Look for details on our website later today.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Par Hawaii, committed to producing renewable fuels for Hawaii's airlines, electric utilities, and other industries. Learn more at parhawaii.com. Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
You know, during our membership campaign, we often re-air a series of recent interviews that we find particularly engaging, illuminating, and educational. Back in March, we spoke with NPR's All Things Considered host, Mary Louise Kelly. That morning, the CEOs of NPR and PBS were testifying before a House subcommittee on government efficiency. It was to question whether public broadcasting should receive federal funding. In July, Congress voted to rescind funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Public radio and television stations across the country, including HPR, lost their federal funding. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Kelly about her recent memoir and her perspective on the role of journalism.
Hi, Maddie. This is Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. How are you this very early morning for you?
Aloha. I am doing well. I didn't think that I would have kind of a visceral reaction to hearing your voice, but very much did. And it puts you exactly in the hour. So I hope that our listeners aren't too confused when we air this at 11 a.m. our time.
Well, exactly. I know Robert Siegel, my predecessor in the exact chair at All Things Considered that I occupy, I know every once in a while when he would have some kind of interview or story that would end up on Morning Edition, half the country would be writing in. They were so confused at hearing Robert Siegel in the air at 7 in the morning. Just was not comprehensible. So hopefully people will survive.
Well, I greatly appreciate you taking the time. And I did want to start also by saying that in your book, the way that you describe running a daily news and interview show is highly relatable, just with the ephemerality of it, of you can do the best story in the world, and the second the show wraps, it's on to the next day. So I'm wondering from you how you manage to hold on to some of the bigger moments and really end up grounding yourself in the day-to-day.
Well, it's so true. The blessing and the curse of hosting a daily evening news program is that, yeah, you no matter what you write, how beautiful it is, how glorious it is, the greatest interview you'll ever do, you wake up and it's a clean slate the next day and you have to do the whole darn thing over again. As I say, that is, it's frustrating sometimes when you've poured your heart and soul into a story and then the whole news cycle moves on. But it's also a quite lovely thing. It's one of my favorite moments of my day. Every day is the 9:30 a.m. Eastern All Things Considered editorial meeting where the whole team, you know, from senior hosts and executive producer to, you know, the new intern are all gathered at a conference room table. And these days, some people are joining from all over via Zoom and pitching, what are the stories you want to cover? And we really live up to the All Things Considered name. So people are pitching stuff all over the map. And I love it because at that time of day, anything is possible. No one's turned us down yet. And every day I come in and think, what am I curious about? What are my questions? Who could answer them? Let's get them on the phone. It's so much fun. The flip is writing a book like It Goes So Fast, which was an attempt to put a pin in one particular year because it does go so fast. And I look back on, I was writing this in real time now a couple of years ago. And as I look back, I think, gosh, I've already forgotten some of these details. I'm so glad I put them down on a page. I've already forgotten exactly how that conversation unfolded or quite how funny it was in the moment. And it makes me realize it's the advice you always get about, you know, take a photograph, not just of, you know, the big smiling people formally posed at a ceremony or a birthday or whatever, but like of the little things, you know, of your kids, sprawled on the floor during their homework. Like that's the stuff that I miss. And that's the kind of thing that I was trying to capture in this book. Let me just take this one year and sit with it.
Yeah. And you write about reckoning with your own choices while still living them, which I think personally is really profound. I wanted to talk about the context. I mean, the time we're living in, but then today, you know, this hearing, NPR and PBS, the heads of them are talking in front of Congress. And there's been a lot made about impartiality in the media. And at the same time, you have projects like yours, or I think about Wildcard with Rachel Martin.
A great show. Yes, highly recommend.
And the rise of, I guess, opinions, but then possibly a distinction between that and an ideological bent. I wonder what you think about that distinction and what the role of voice, if not ideological bent, has in the newsroom.
I think it's always been important. And if anything, I feel more committed to the mission now than when I was starting out in this business. I look at the news media today, we face all kinds of challenges. We face challenges to do with funding. We face challenges to do with, as you noted, they were watching as you and I speak, the CEO of NPR, who's testifying on Capitol Hill today. One of the things I love about working at NPR is that we will cover ourselves and this debate as we would any other story. That is firewalled from our PR team or the big corporate bosses. We're not a corporation, but the leaders of NPR will have no input into the journalism that's being conducted in the newsroom on this story, and that's a great thing. I think what I can do in this moment is continue to ask questions in the service of finding out what decisions are being made and why, and holding people in positions of power to account. That's what we do. And to your question about the role of opinion, hats off to my colleagues in the media who write brilliant, opinionated op-eds and go on cable news and do analysis. That's important work. I'm glad they're doing it. It's not what I choose to do, because I think, if anything, the value of old bootstrap reporting is elevated in this moment. We are trying to operate with facts in a fact-based reality. And there is huge value in journalists going out into our country, into our communities, and out in the world and sharing with our audience what we see, what we hear, what it looks like. And then people can make up their own minds what they want to think about it. That kind of journalism is expensive. It costs money to send our correspondents out into the world. It costs money to send me and my team out to report stories. And NPR continues to do that on a tight nonprofit public radio budget because we believe in that and the value that it brings to people who are in our audience listening and reading our work.
Yeah. And maybe I could have phrased some of that question better, because as someone who runs an interview show, I do actually feel like there is some opinion involved in choosing which voices to elevate and which guests to book, even if at the end of the day, what I'm doing is that shoe leather reporting.
Well, and absolutely. And I, these are discussions that we have in our newsroom all the time. What voices are we booking? Who do we want to hear from? What's the range of voices that we put on air? Part of the job of hosting a program like All Things Considered is we're going to put all kinds of voices with all kinds of views. I don't feel any obligation to balance truth with lies, but I do feel an obligation to put people with a range of views. And people who are in positions of power, who are making decisions that impact our country in real time, to ask them respectful but tough questions about why they think what they think, why they're doing what they do, how that squares with the facts. And then again, people can make up their own mind what they want to think of the people I or you are interviewing.
We've been hearing from All Things Considered host Mary Louise Kelly, and we'll have more from this conversation right after a short break.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters La Piha Makahiki, a 100% ka'u blend with notes of strawberry jam, brown sugar, and sweet lime at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com or at their cafe in Hilo. Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Earlier, we were hearing from All Things Considered host Mary Louise Kelly. In her memoir, Kelly writes about the aftermath of a memorable 2020 interview that she conducted with then-Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. She asked the secretary whether he owed the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine an apology. Here's a clip from the segment that aired on All Things Considered.
One further question on this.
I appreciate that. I appreciate you want to continue to talk about this. I agreed to come on your
show
today.
And you appreciate that the American public wants to know, as a shadow foreign policy, as a back channel policy on Ukraine was being developed, did you try to block it?
The Ukraine policy has been run from the Department of State for the entire time that I have been here, and our policy was very clear.
Marie Yovanovitch testified under oath that Ukraine policy was hijacked.
I've been clear about that. I know exactly what we were doing. I know precisely what the direction that the State Department gave to our officials around the world about how to manage our Ukraine policy.
Thank you.
Secretary, thank you. Thank you.
Mary Louise Kelly is here in the studio. And Mary Louise, will you explain what's happening at the end of the interview there?
Hey, Ari, what is happening there is an aide has stopped the interview, said, "We're done, thank you." Mm-hmm. And you heard me thank the secretary. He did not reply. He leaned in, glared at me, and then turned and, with his aides, left the room. Moments later, the same staffer who had stopped the interview reappeared, asked me to come with her, just me, no recorder, though she did not say we were off the record, nor would I have agreed. Mm-hmm. I was taken to the secretary's private living room, where he was waiting, and where he shouted at me for about the same amount of time as the interview itself had lasted. He was not happy to have been questioned about Ukraine. He asked, "Do you think Americans care about Ukraine?" He used the F word in that sentence and many others. He asked if I could find Ukraine on a map. I said yes. He called out for his aides to bring him a map of the world with no writing, no countries marked.
Huh.
I pointed to Ukraine. He put the map away. He said, "People will hear about this." And then he turned and said he had things to do. And I thanked him again for his time and left.
Wow.
We have reached out to the State Department to let them know we plan to report this coda to the interview, and we have not yet heard back.
Following that interview, Pompeo accused Kelly of lying. NPR's public editor at the time called Kelly's reporting exemplary ethical journalism. HPR's Maddie Bender spoke with Kelly about the role of facts and opinions in the newsroom and how to hold powerful figures accountable.
On that topic of holding sources accountable, holding truth to power, you write about your interview with Mike Pompeo in the book. I think many are also having another moment of seemingly alternative facts right now with the recent story that broke, Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic being added to a group chat, seemingly with leaders of this nation. And I just want to know, what does some of the preparation for the interviews you conduct look like when you have a fair chance of having to fact check in real time?
Yeah, some of my preparation is very basic, is just sitting and thinking, what do I really want to know that this particular person can answer? And if you go into interview, say, the Secretary of State, there's a million things you want to ask about a million different parts of the world and their aspects of their work. You're going to get to, you know, in 10, 15 minutes, you're going to get to like two or three. And I try to think of the more complex a subject, the more basic my questions should probably be. And so it starts with, what do I actually want to know? How can I frame a question that will elicit an answer to that? Part of my prep is, it's every interview I do is building on the last, and it helps enormously. So you mentioned the Mike Pompeo interview, then Secretary of State in President Trump's first term. The two things I wanted to question him about in that interview were Iran and Ukraine. And it was very helpful that right, you know, a couple of weeks before I sat down and interviewed him, I had been in Iran. And so I had interviewed his counterpart, the then foreign minister of Iran. I had interviewed ordinary people out and about in the streets and markets and restaurants in Iran. And that helps enormously in preparing for an interview here in Washington to say, I've been out, I've seen that part of the world. Here's what I'm hearing. How do you respond to that? That's the kind of preparation that I do. And partly it's just, you don't think too hard about the kind of, I don't think too hard about what the agenda going is. I'm not trying to ask gotcha questions. I'm just trying to ask a question or two that will advance our audience's knowledge of U.S. foreign policy. That's what you do when you go to interview the Secretary of State. And that remains the mission the next time I get the chance to do it.
Mary Louise Kelly, All Things Considered host and author of It Goes So Fast. Thank you so much for taking the time.
It has been a pleasure. Thanks for your questions.
That was NPR All Things Considered host Mary Louise Kelly talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Kelly's memoir is titled It Goes So Fast, The Year of No Do-Overs. In August, NPR announced a new national security podcast hosted by Kelly called Sources and Methods. Well, that does it for us today. I'm Catherine Cruz.